It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law here on the Talk Station, the right advice at the right time. And Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins are back in the studio with us this morning. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Ben. How are you? Doing all right. What are we talking about today?
Well, my understanding is last week, Wes, I was not here last Tuesday, but I understand that you guys spoke about will caveats, but you had some callers, which is always nice, and we're going to continue to talk about that subject today, a will caveat.
Okay.
You know, right out of the gate, Ben, the most important thing about a will caveat is let's not have a will caveat.
That's the way that one
attempts to avoid that at all costs is to have a document that is clear and not ambiguous, that addresses, you know, in an upfront kind of manner, any kind of unusual circumstances. One of the big ones, and this is not always a will caveat case, but, you know, so many folks, unfortunately, for whatever reason, need to maybe exclude someone in their will. Sometimes it's a child, a grandchild, whatever the case might be, or they maybe need to include a stepchild, for instance, or a step-grandchild. This language needs to be clear, okay? If you're going to exclude or include someone, then there needs to be clear language to that effect. And it's not the old adage that sometimes I think folks have seen in movies where you have to give them $100.
That's right.
I mean, if you want to exclude Mary, then let's just say we're going to exclude Mary.
That was actually one of our questions last time.
Okay.
Right?
Good. I'm not surprised because it is a very common scenario and therefore common question. The will just needs to be clear in an imprimis or somewhere that this particular heir is not included, not included in the definition of child or grandchild or whatever the case might be. But again, one of the biggest places to begin with the caveat with talking about will caveats is just, you know, let's try to avoid them. They're costly, as Wes I'm sure mentioned last week, there are many times, well, almost all times, a jury trial. And
they
so
have to be.
They have to be. And as a result of that, you know, they are costly to put a trial forth for a week, 2 weeks, the depositions ahead of trial. We're about to go into one in Superior Court trial here in another week or so. So, you know, they are a costly proposition, and we try to avoid them if we can.
And as Cecil was saying, the way to really do that is a well drafted from the beginning. But often you guys are coming in putting out the fire. I mean, you don't see the well drafted.
That's right. And before a will caveat is filed, and you know what this is a challenge to the validity of a will. So, you know, we're in a situation where someone has passed away, the will has been put on record, the probate process has been started, and that's public record, by the way. Of course, you can go look at any estate file and determine. You know, get a copy of the will, look at the will, so on and so forth. And so someone's passed away. We're in a situation where we now see this will, and maybe family members, loved ones have some concern about what's going on with this will. As we mentioned last week, you know, in most cases when folks bring a will caveat or they at least come to see the lawyer about challenging a will, there's something surprising in the document. Someone's left out. Or maybe too much is being left to a caregiver or everything to a caregiver. Or,
it was changed a week earlier.
The will was signed 2 days before the person died, you know, these kind of things. So, but there's a lot of analysis, Ben, that goes into looking at whether we're actually going to proceed with a challenge to a will before we actually do it. The analysis really, you know, starts with things like, do we have a good basis for challenging this will? I mean, you don't just, because you don't like what the will says, states, challenge it. You have to have some basis. The primary things, as we touched on last week before we, you know, had several callers and kind of, you know, went down those paths, are undue influence. Is this person subjected to influence from another that really ends up being the other person's decision instead of the testator's decision, the person who signed the will. Secondly is lack of capacity. And that they kind of go hand in hand because if someone has a diminished capacity, then they're probably going to be more susceptible to influence.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at those two things, but you also look at what's the effect of what we're doing. In the event that this will is set aside, is there a previous will? What does the previous will do? Because the operation of setting aside a will, it revives the previous will in the event the previous will was revoked by the will to set aside.
Okay. All right.
And what I mean there is, let's say we have a previous will and there's evidence that it was ripped up on purpose before we ever execute the new will. Okay. So then that previous will probably would have been revoked by the actions of ripping it up. But those are unusual facts. Normally you're sitting in a situation where either you have a will that you're challenging or wanting to challenge, and there wasn't a will beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we have to analyze through intestacy where the assets, the estate would pass if there is no will. The other scenario is that, you know, we have a previous will, and we need to gather some information with regard to that because, you know, we don't want to aimlessly go through the process of, you know, filing a will caveat and try to set this will aside when we don't really know what's going to happen in the event that we're successful.
Right.
So we have to look at all those issues. Other things we look at would be what assets that passed aren't controlled by the will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we've talked about on the program before, you know, tenants by entirety property, for example, husband and wife property. It's going to pass outside the will to the surviving spouse, okay? Joint property with right of survivorship, like real estate, that's going to pass outside the will directly to the joint survivors.
Mm-hmm.
Accounts with beneficiary designation or joint accounts or POD accounts or life insurance, you know, these type things, they end up passing under contract, under how the account was set up as opposed to, you know, the will. So in many cases, you know, we're having to analyze all these things and make a determination as to whether we're really going to achieve much by challenging this will. But in many cases as well, we proceed with the will caveat with the knowledge that maybe there are other non-probate assets or we think that there may be, and we get the benefit of discovery, the discovery process through interrogatories and requests for production of documents, these tools that we have under the rules of civil procedure, subpoena power, and we learn about other things. I've had many cases where we proceed along the lines of a will caveat, and we think that there is undue influence or someone's been taken advantage of, who may have some diminished capacity. And then through the discovery process, we learn that there's a lot more to it, being that not only was the will manipulated, or the person who signed the will, they were manipulated, but his or her accounts were manipulated as well.
Oh, okay.
By like using a power of attorney to change beneficiary designations at a time when the person would not have had the capacity to do it himself or herself.
Are those two separate actions?
They are. Yeah.
They are.
In many cases, we start with a will caveat, and we're proceeding down that path.
And in discovery, you learn.
We learned so much about how much dirty work was done by this person who had to do with getting the will done to benefit themselves that we end up bringing a separate action for breach of fiduciary duty, constructive fraud, conversion, some of these claims. But that's more of a plaintiff versus defendant lawsuit where a will caveat is an in rem proceeding, which is the thing, the will. We're putting it before the jury. We're putting it on evidence. You make a determination, jury, as to whether it is or it is not the final will of the person. So,
Ben, you know, we've spoken so many times on the program about these, quote, non-probate or assets.
Right.
And, you know, let's pause a minute and just repeat that because it really is the cousin, the first cousin to a will caveat case is the fact that, you know, there is an account, be it a stock account, be it a bank account, be it a CD, that, quote, you know, I added my child on, I added my daughter on the account because I wanted her to be able to pay my bills.
Right, right.
You know, I added my son because I wanted him to have access to my money to pay my bills if anything happened.
Imagine you see this every day, don't
you? Well, the will, of course, leaves, you know, the assets three ways,
mm-hmm.
okay? Not just to the one child, but the one child, of course, was titled on the account. Now, you know, that is the first cousin to a will caveat because there we see that the intention of the testator, the intention of the decedent, is really not necessarily being honored, and it puts the family in a very awkward position. It kindles up the fire for there to be, you know, significant conflict. You must be very careful about the way in which you allow banking institutions, your stock institutions, mm-hmm. your various folks who hold your liquidity
mm-hmm.
to the way in which the forms are signed in a way where beneficiaries are named. We're handling an estate right now, and it, of course, you know, I hate to pick on the banks and the stock companies, but I tell you, as a lawyer, it is just, it's just really astonishing what we see.
Mm-hmm.
We sent the executor in to close out the bank account, which in this particular file was quite significant, you know, $80,000-$90,000
mm-hmm.
in this gentleman's, you know, checking account. And of course, he had it just in his name.
Mm-hmm.
The right. bank was so astonished that there was no joint registration, mm-hmm. payable on death, time on death, whatever you want to call it, that they had to stop the transfer of the account to the executor, which is where it should go, to
right.
the estate of the executor, and seek legal advice because they were shocked that there was no joint tenant, payable on death, time on death. They're so used to seeing that now. Okay.
Was that because they had some evidence that he had done that or something like that, or they just thought that's the way it always is?
They just thought that's the way it always is.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. And again, this person actually did it correctly.
He did it correctly.
But it's being challenged because it's not the way most people were doing it.
Correct.
So we'll have more to come in a moment here on Let's Talk Legal. You're invited to join us too, 247-7282, if you'd like to ask a question about your legal life. And we're back here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, talking about will caveats and some of the things that are done with assets that are non-probate assets and that are done kind of as a matter of course. But again, in the caveat, imagine again, are sometimes people are challenging not just the entirety of the will, but maybe challenging a portion of it. Is that different from is it all or nothing?
Great question. The jury has one choice. Is it the will or is it not?
Hmm.
They can't cut and paste and say I like this and don't like this and those type things. You know, and that brings up another good point. A lot of times I hear from folks, well, I know that this isn't what my daddy or my granddaddy or my uncle or whatever, mm-hmm. my aunt wanted to do because they told me what they wanted to do. And this will isn't what they said. Well, that basically gets you nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter what they said. It doesn't matter what they indicated they wanted. And moreover, if you're an interested party, you can't testify about what they said
mm-hmm.
because we have a rule in North Carolina dead man statute. An interested party cannot testify in a way that would benefit themselves as it relates to what someone who's deceased said.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we have a third party mm-hmm. Who won't benefit, they can certainly testify about what the person said to show that maybe they didn't understand
mm-hmm.
what they were doing when they sign the respective document.
There's
the will.
Actually a particular kind of will that's generated by a third party that has no interest in that.
Right.
Orally.
Yeah. That's right.
Non-competitive will.
Yeah, that's right. We don't see those very often.
No,
but yes, North Carolina does recognize those, like deathbed wills.
But it's the idea is that there's a third party doesn't have a dog in the fight.
That's right. So there are not really many jurisdictions that have this dead man statute. North Carolina is one, but obviously the reason that we have that is because you can't cross-examine the person who's deceased.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously someone who's going to come in and testify in a way to benefit themselves about what someone indicated verbally, during their lifetime, it raises questions about the validity of it, the credibility, those type things.
Sure.
So, but that is a rule that I deal with on a daily basis in all my litigation cases dealing with estate matters.
Well, I have a friend actually who's asked me to be an executor to a will, and in it they have a very particular item they want passed along. Well, that item, pretty good chance that item's not going to exist.
Right.
And by the time he passes away, I think he's maybe feeling particularly mortal at the time that he wrote it. But it's a vehicle, and so what happens then? Does the person who would normally receive that get something?
No. If there's a specific bequest about the vehicle and the vehicle's gone, then the vehicle's gone. You don't get the specific bequest. That's just the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that sometimes. And it's a good idea if we want to leave something specifically that may get lost, a mm-hmm. ring or a piece of jewelry or something like that, then it's a good idea to identify these things with mm-hmm. some specificity. Otherwise, we don't really know to look for the diamond ring,
right.
so on and
you
so
know,
forth.
Whatever automobile I happen to own at the time of my death.
That would be a better way to specify
whatever automobile
that.
I happen to own,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, 2012, Impala Chevrolet. I mean, mm-hmm. we may not still own that particular vehicle.
Right.
We run into this also with people wanting to specifically name a particular bank account
mm-hmm.
or a particular stock or something, a stock account or something of that nature. And this is the company and this is the account number, Mr. Harvell.
Mm-hmm.
I want this particular account to go to this particular person. Well, that's a real problem because account numbers are always changing.
Right. Right.
Okay. Banking institutions' names are changing
mm-hmm.
Constantly. And so right there is a signal to the lawyer in our area of practice that you could very easily be setting up, a caveat or
mm-hmm.
a confusion in the estate plan by naming some specific account. You've got to come up with other methods, and there are those, of
mm-hmm.
course, as a good estate planning lawyer. There are other ways to handle that, but not by being so specific with regard to something that may not be there when we die,
mm-hmm.
5 years, 10 years, 15, 12 years, whatever the case might be.
Mm-hmm.
An automobile is a big one.
So, for example, years ago, we had a will that indicated I leave my account at Wachovia Bank, number
mm-hmm.
123456. Well, then Wachovia gets bought out by Wells
right.
Fargo. Now, let's be logical about this. I think we can follow the money,
mm-hmm.
but the law doesn't necessarily allow us to follow the money.
Oh.
If we're specifically identifying
mm-hmm.
that account with that number and it doesn't exist because Wells Fargo has bought it out, account number may have changed, we can't identify that. Therefore, it's not captured. So the way we draft, our documents, we have to take that into consideration and we may be able to be specific about a particular, collector's item vehicle or something
mm-hmm.
like that,
mm-hmm.
or like I said, jewelry, those type things. But, certainly agree with Cecil. If the intent is that whatever vehicle I own, I want to go to this person, whatever home I own, sometimes we don't deal with a particular address of a piece of real property. If the intent is that whatever home I live in upon my death, I want it to go to this person, then we're very broad
mm-hmm.
as it relates to that. But this is, more along the lines of will interpretation,
right.
not caveat.
Right.
But again, back to your question, the jury in a caveat proceeding, a will challenge, doesn't get into the nooks and crannies of the document itself.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking at, excuse me, the issue of lack of capacity, undue influence. They could potentially look at things like whether the witnesses actually did see the person
mm-hmm.
sign the document. We have to have the two witnesses. In the event you don't have that, then there's a problem. but they don't have the right to, the jury, the court doesn't have the right to change the will by getting into the language, like taking out this paragraph, that paragraph, those type things.
Mm-hmm.
It either is or it isn't. That's the question before the jury. Divisit vel non, that's the Latin term.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll take a short break. We'll be back with more here on Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station. And Let's Talk Legal with Harv Alley Collins. Your questions are welcome at 247-7282. And welcome back to Let's Talk Legal. Cecil Harvell with us. Wes had to step out. But Cecil, as we finish up about will caveats and those challenges to the will, I think so many people, as you have said, we helped them demystify the Hollywood notion of how wills are handled and how they're challenged and et cetera. But
almost all of the caveats that really become significant in nature evolve around maybe a couple of issues, which I'm sure you all discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Capacity.
Right.
You know, was there the capacity at the time, for this person to sign a will?
Mm-hmm.
Were they able to know the nature of their assets, the nature of the effect of the document that they're signing, and who their heirs happen to be? The second one that we see is, of course, undue influence,
mm-hmm.
Where the person who is making out the will, the testator, is under the influence of someone and is therefore not really cogent and clear, but is rather following through with the actions of another. So most caveats that really begin to frame up and that we see go to the full extent of a jury trial are involving one or two of those two issues or both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Not only did they not have the capacity to make out the document, but at the time, the son, the daughter, the granddaughter, whoever was influencing the testator to make provisions in the last will and testament in their favor. These are the issues that we most likely are confronted in a will caveat case. The way around that, of course, is quite frankly for the attorneys who are preparing the documents to make sure that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed.
Right,
we need a letter from a physician about the fact that the testator has capacity to handle their affairs, then let's get that letter,
mm-hmm.
and let's have it within a month or so, give or take, before or after the signing of the document. Let's have some additional testimony, if you will, or affirmations at the execution of the document when it's being signed,
mm-hmm.
to the witnesses where it's made clear that the testator has understands the nature of the document that they're signing, the effect of the document that they are signing, so that the witnesses can later be able to say in affidavit form, gosh, Mr. Jones, you know, told me what day of the week it was. He told me who his children were. Told me where his land was located.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take some extra precautions on the front end to avoid those kinds of expensive propositions on the back end.
Right. So the red flags aren't raised.
Correct.
Take care of it in front.
Right.
Side. All right. You can do that by making your appointment again with Harv Alley Collins Attorneys at Law. You can find them online at harvellandcollins.com, where you can also listen to all the past shows.